You are listening to 97.3 LPFM WRIR, and this is Open Source RVA. On this week's Open Source RVA, we talk with Ann Ritter, Sarah Wilson McKay, and Rachel Cohen of Project Redux, speak with Spencer Turner of the Virginia Center for Latin American Art, and artist Norberto Gomez Jr. about Gomez's exhibit at First Fridays, and check in with past and current school board members who are critical of the city's progress in enforcing anti-truancy efforts. I'm Amy Daniel, and here's some of the top stories making headlines right now. Richmond's favorite food on the go has found a home. Building on last summer's regional fascination with gourmet food trucks, a dozen or so of these micro-entrepreneurs have come together as a cooperative, calling itself RVA Street Foodies. The new organization, which its founders are calling a social enterprise business because of its student training partnership with the Richmond Technical Center, will serve as an umbrella business structure, allowing it to manage the healthy proliferation of food truck courts that popped up around Richmond last summer and fall. The organization's co-founders, Malcolm Andrus and Paul Casimus, both operate frozen dessert carts and admit it'd make more sense for them to be rivals, but both say they're looking past quick, short-term profits to achieve long-term stability for this vibrant new business model. "We realize by working together as vendors with our supporting organizations, we can make each event better," Casimus says. The group also seeks to make better outcomes for Richmond school kids through its partnership with the Technical Center, where RVA Street Foodies will help develop entrepreneurial programs with the intent of putting kids in business for themselves. The RVA Street Foodies' first official event, a partnership with Grow RVA, an area farmers market operator, kicks off tonight at First Friday. The ongoing saga of the Richmond Police Department versus the Wingnut Anarchist Collective continues. And if it continues much longer, it could prove to be a very expensive proposition for Richmond taxpayers. Lacking grounds for a criminal case against Wingnut member Mariah Karn, the police department has engaged the law firm of Reed Smith LLC to pursue a civil case on its behalf, according to various officials familiar with the case who have spoken with Open Source RVA. Justin Sizemore, an attorney with Reed Smith, has been retained by the Richmond Police Department at a rate of $330 per hour, according to Richmond Police General Counsel Victoria Pearson, who responded late and only partially to a Freedom of Information request submitted by Open Source. According to court documents and to Pearson's FOIA response, the department's civil case was filed on November 15th, shortly before an appearance on this program by Karn and a man who has been identified in court documents as John Q. Public. Public, who appeared on our show anonymously, alleged that he'd found a computer thumb drive containing various police documents, including a version of the department's operations manual. The Wingnut then published portions of the thumb drive's contents, which prompted police to hire Sizemore, who secured a court injunction for the removal of the documents from the internet. Police, according to city officials, are probing whether Karn, Public, or others broke any laws in obtaining or publishing the documents. Pearson declined to say how much police so far have spent on Sizemore and Reed Smith, indicating that the department has not yet been billed by the law firm. She declined to provide the number of hours worked or the amount owed to the firm. Your favorite radio station is throwing a party and everyone is invited. WRIR 97.3 LPFM is celebrating its 8th anniversary tonight at the Renaissance Ballroom at 107 West Broad Street. Featured will be many of Richmond's finest musical acts, including Canario Canary, Dead Fame, Wolf Goat, and Samson Trin and the Upper East Side Big Band. WRIR DJs will spin tunes, and the Richmond Comedy Coalition will feature its locally flavored Richmond Famous show. There will also be a local hip-hop showcase presented by the Cheats Movement blog. Suggested donation to the event is $10. Interested parties are encouraged to come on down and party with the rest of us, starting at 7 p.m. For more information on this anniversary blowout, go to WRIR.org.
It's one thing to recycle stuff. It's another to recycle ideas, And it's yet another thing to recycle an idea to recycle stuff. But that's Stuff Redux. Best described, if you're into euphemisms, as a creative reuse center, Stuff Redux is trash reimagined as the basic building blocks of the next great childhood artistic masterpiece. Bring them your tired, your poor, your discarded paper, fabric, yarn scraps, construction materials, and bits of ribbon. Stuff Redux is a creative mashup, an idea first conceived by a VCU pediatric neurosurgeon tired of watching trashy treasures go to waste, and shared with VCU's arts education department. Stuff Redux opens to the public this month, a community meeting place and arts education center. I'm with Sarah Wilson McKay. She's chairwoman of the Department of Art Education in the School of Arts at VCU, Rachel Cohen, project director and a grad student in the arts education department at VCU, and with Ann Ritter. She's a pediatric neurosurgeon at VCU Medical Center. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
We're great.
Great.
All right. And we don't have to redux this this interview, hopefully. And real quick, it is redux, not redux.
It is redux.
And it is stuff, right?
Stuff redux.
All right. And tell me a little bit about it. Who wants to start, I guess? And this project started kind of with you, right?
It did kind of start with me. I was finding that we were disposing of a lot of clean items in the OR that actually my kids' art students wanted to use and the art teacher wanted to reuse. And I started this with just kind of picking it up from the OR and taking it to her, and then started off then taking it to the Children's Museum. And they would recycle them into creative projects.
And I have to ask, what kind of stuff would you take out of the OR?
Things, yeah, you guys are probably thinking, what is she doing? No, this is all stuff, obviously, that does not have any contact with patients. So this is like normal saline bottles. When we put water on the back of a table, they would then donate the plastic bottle to us.
Okay.
Also some tubs that we don't use. And I was getting a little overwhelmed with this project on my own, so I actually got in touch with Dr. Sarah Wilson McKay, who then thought of this as a project which someone had actually tried to start 3 years earlier, called Stuff. And then I'll let her finish that because that's kind of how this project then became kind of reborn.
Well, and now before you start, tell me a little bit, one of you, what Stuff is exactly, or what Stuff Redux is.
A Stuff Redux is a creative reuse center, which means that we have a home, we have a storage space where we're going to take in supplies and materials from individuals and businesses, and then we resell those materials to the community for very, very low price and use the revenue from that to run workshops and classes that feature creativity, art, and environmental sustainability.
And are these kids' projects, or are these everybody?
They're for kids and for adults. We have a couple in the works, and some of them are for kids. Some of them are for adults.
All right. And now enter Sarah. So she comes to you and says, hey, I've got all this stuff.
Well, actually, she was very persistent, saying, we need to talk about all this material that I have. And I said, well, okay, let's get together.
And were you having trouble getting on her calendar?
No, I was not. I was not, but I was pretty persistent because I was having a lot of stuff in the back of my car and in the garage.
Yes. Yeah. Well, anyway, so I came down to the hospital to meet with Ann. And while we were in the meeting room, there was, in fact, a big pile of stuff that she...
wanted her to take that day.
And as we were talking, it triggered a memory of the Stuff initiative that had started under the direction of Sarah Branigan, who is now an art teacher at Holton Elementary School. But at that time, she was the program coordinator of the art education department.
Was she also a student at the time?
No, she was a full-time staff member of our department, and she was just trying to begin this really amazing initiative with some pals in the evenings and on weekends, and they just hit brick wall after brick wall.
Now, did they have a place for their stuff?
They did not have a place, and that was the massive obstacle that they couldn't seem to overcome. They did amazing programming. They reached out to the community in fantastic ways, but it was just... without a housing space for all the materials, they really couldn't realize their dreams.
So now what I think is really interesting about this version, this redux of stuff, is that now there's sort of a, I don't know, this is the right time, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have as I understand it, President Rao at VCU has definite interest in seeing some collaboration and cooperation between...
Yeah, the most recent version of the strategic plan of the university has definitely foregrounded the idea of inter-campus collaboration. And, you know, obviously with Dr. Ritter down at the medical campus and with us up in the School of the Arts, it was a natural outgrowth. And additionally, within VCU Arts, we have numerous medical arts initiatives. And this just, it was a perfect home for one more initiative.
And I'm calling him President Rao. It's, of course, President Michael Rao, mm-hmm. president of the university. We're seeing some other collaboration type stuff at the university as well, as I understand, between the arts and the medical school. The ICA is a good example, mm-hmm. it seems like, of something where Joe Seipel, who's the head of everything at the arts department, has made it a kind of a big deal that this thing is going to be trying to bring those two departments together in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, the interdisciplinary nature of the arts lends itself so beautifully to having a contemporary arts space where there really is a space for dialogue across sort of disparate communities. And when we started looking at the crazy materials that Anne was bringing out of the operating room, that was, you know, clean, but...
Perfectly sanitary.
Perfectly sanitary, but no longer useful.
And you would not believe what a child can make out of these. And it's truly creative. And I don't ever believe myself to be creative. I consider myself to be very black and white in what I do, but... To see, first off, what these ladies have done with the stuff that we have brought them and what the kids have done with it.
I'm sure that some of your ideas
just flabbergasted.
Probably came from taking it home to your own kids.
I did, and that's, yeah, they still have a bunch of stuff in my house. But it is true what they can do with it that I never thought of. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that, too, that sometimes there are materials you encounter every day in your work or wherever you are that you only see as a container or you only see as a sponge for surgery. But the minute you take it into a different context, into an art context, you know, that sponge is a paintbrush, or you can cut it up and you can print with it, or that container is an armature for a sculpture. So it's having those differentiated eyes on it, which is really cool.
Now you're listening to Open Source, and I'm with Sarah Wilson McKay and Rachel Cohen and Ann Ritter, and they're the founders of Stuff Redux, I guess, and or at least one of or two of them are sort of the founders, and one is running it. Mm-hmm. And Stuff Redux, again, is a kind of a community junk center and space, right, where you can go and make junk into
stuff. A community valuable materials center.
I love some of your language in your literature. Your what is it? Let's see. It was creativity, art, environmental sustainability, and education, and community engagement are all mm-hmm. the things that you're about. Mm-hmm. And then it's collection and redistribution of traditionally discarded materials,
that's
which
right.
is like code for trash.
But not trash.
Yeah.
So tell me real quick, you're going to have a space, right? We're yeah. almost to that. Where is your space going to be?
Our space is at 1605 Road Miller, which is right behind the SPCA and in between the SPCA and Feedmore.
Okay, that seems like a great place.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's awesome. It's a really, really great location because we have, you know, Feedmore and SPCA, which are both great organizations right near us. We're close to Hardywood.
for the parents.
So that's always nice.
And Diversity Thrift is very close by. And can I tell you, we are truly lucky because from what I'm hearing from Sarah and the other Sarah who worked so hard at this, the fact is they got to a stalling point because they didn't have a place and they didn't have anybody to help them with the things that we have the ability to help them with, like the 501c3 for the nonprofit status. So we have actually MCVP, which is our foundation, our physicians, who actually donated that space mm-hmm. to us. It used to be our billing office.
Wow,
so Dr. John
okay.
Ward is actually the president of MCVP, and he actually worked that space for us. So that was actually donated.
That was incredible.
So that, I mean, that was kind of like, because that was one of our worries is, am I doing this out of my garage for the rest of my life? And so once we got that space, I think we all kind of went, okay, now we can go on with getting the nonprofit status and getting the donations.
Mm-hmm. So the location is now yours? It belongs to the...
It is donated to us for a lease amount of space.
Okay, so you have a lease period
time,
of time.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Oh, that's
correct.
Great.
And it's
mm-hmm.
actually behind, if thank goodness, hopefully people are going to start coming.
Yeah.
it's actually behind. We're actually...
Yeah, the front, we are in the back of the building.
Right.
So it's actually a really large warehouse space, and we have two smaller rooms that sort of come out from the back. So if you come to that address, you're going to be at an empty building. You have to come around
the back. Right.
And we have directions on our website, so hopefully.
I actually think that entrance is really awesome because it opens up to the green space of the alley. Mm-hmm. And
it's handicap accessible, which is nice.
And we have a lot of ideas to have, hopefully, maybe some things in that space. So it's actually, although it's in the back of a building, it's truly, that's not a deterrent.
Okay.
It has some neat
character.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of addresses in Richmond used to be in alleyways, so this is just going back to what has always been Richmond,
I guess. There you go.
So now you guys, you don't open until February, right?
We open February 22nd, that's Friday, and that's the first day that we'll actually be in the store ready to sell stuff. We are, however, open and ready to accept donations and donated materials.
Immediately.
Yeah, immediately. And all you have to do for that is email us at stuffreduxrva@gmail.com. And we're always there on Saturdays between 11 and 5. And then if you have something really special, we could make an appointment.
Make an appointment for that trash.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so your regular hours for when the public can come once you're open in February is going to be Friday and Saturday?
Friday and Saturday, 11 to 5.
Now, to be clear, though, you also have some events that you're rolling out before you're open, right?
Yes, absolutely.
So you're going to be tonight, First Friday.
Mm-hmm. We'll be at First Friday. We'll be at Gallery 5. Gallery 5 has been awesome in letting us come and set up there. We'll have a table with information as well as some fun crafts for people to do and some things for you to take home.
Is that going to be weather permitting or you're inside?
We're inside, yeah.
Okay.
Well, weather permitting, we'll be outside. We actually have an art cart. We have a bicycle with a trailer that we're going to take around to different events and do fun crafts with. So if it's warm enough, we'll bring that, but otherwise we'll be inside.
This is great. It's a wonderful thing. Is the other Sarah still involved at all?
You know, when we were sort of digging through what all the amazing legwork she had done at that time, she was so generous to share all of her incredible knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we sort of talked about her relationship to this new initiative is sort of as the grandmother of the initiative.
We didn't tell her that, though, did we?
Actually, she was totally
okay, good.
She was totally cool with it. You know, having a very young grandmother.
All grandmothers are
sort of that foundational level. She did so much work that we want to honor and respect and, you know, continue to build on. And Rachel has done an amazing
job.
Staying true and extending that vision.
And I have to say that Sarah did put excellent building blocks in place for me, because mm-hmm. when I did start to go out and talk to people about this, they'd say, oh, I remember that. That was weren't you around like 3 years ago? And, you know, I'd explain the story, but basically that was still in people's minds. It was still ruminating, which means it was a really powerful idea and still mm-hmm. is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would agree. Even, you know, when we would go to the little carts behind the Virginia Fine Arts Museum during the summer, you'd have people come up and say, I can't wait for you guys. This is just going to be such a neat idea.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just hoping enough people actually realize that it's coming to fruition and mm-hmm. we get the momentum behind us to keep going.
It is a really neat idea. And so, again, I'm with Sarah Wilson McKay. She's the chairwoman of the Department of Art Education at the School of Arts at VCU. Rachel Cohen, she's a project director of this new Stuff Redux.
Mm-hmm.
and she's also a grad student at the in art education at VCU. And then Ann Ritter, who's the brains behind the operation, so to speak, and also a brain surgeon. She's a pediatric neurosurgeon at VCU. And thank you guys for being here.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
All right, Stuff Redux. We'll see you guys tonight, hopefully.
Yeah, great. Thank come
you.
On out.
All right, and come on down to our party as well. We're down the street.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic. Thanks.
Thank you.
Si tierra mía, dime qué has hecho de nuestro dulce hogar. Reina que un día fue la alegría de todo aquel.
There's a new Virginia on the rise, argue the folks behind the Virginia Center for Latin American Art. The newly formed organization, known as VACLA, say that they are about helping the area's Latino population find their creative voice, while also assisting non-Latinos in getting to know the culture and diversity of people of Latin descent. VACLA has already grabbed media attention through their Galleria Movimiento, a traveling mobile art gallery inside a bus that sets up in different locations. Tonight, the Gallery on Wheels will be parked at First Fridays and will be showcasing the work of local artist Norberto Gomez Jr., whose topics of interest include skulls, the life, death, and rebirth of time and space, cannibal exploitation cinema, and music. We're pleased to have Norberto Gomez Jr. here with us today on Open Source RVA, along with Spencer Turner, who co-founded Vakla with his wife, Ava Roach. Thanks for coming, you guys.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
I'll start with you, Spencer. Give us the origins of Vakla and tell us what gave you and your wife, Ava, the idea that this would be right for Richmond.
Well, we were back in 2011, November, we were at the Latin American Family Day at the Virginia Museum. And I'm from Richmond, grew up here, and have seen it evolve. And was so impressed with the idea that there was such a strong group of Latino population in Richmond now that they could have an event like that. Mm-hmm. Was just so overjoyed to see these artists of Latino descent. And so we started talking to them about the idea. And it seemed like folks were interested in finding a space that they could, share their artistic sensibilities with the community. And it sort of evolved from there. And as we were thinking about how we would just even financially make it feasible to have an art space, we realized that having a brick-and-mortar space was a great idea and a goal, but mm-hmm. that it would be very costly. So we, after talking to several folks, realized that having a bus would not only help us with that, but actually be an end in its own, that it would actually serve a great purpose in terms of reaching out to the Latino community, many of whom live not in the city, but in South Side. They live in the city, but they live mm-hmm. Further away from the downtown area. So instead of us asking them to make the trek and come downtown to experience art, we could also go out and reach out to them and bring art to places where it hadn't normally been.
Norberto, talk a little bit about your beginnings and what prompted you to pursue visual art. You're from Texas, right?
Yeah, I'm from South Texas originally, a small town called Alice, Texas. I've been in Richmond for almost 4 years now. So moved from Houston, so I was in South Texas, moved to Houston, big city, was in that big art world. I guess it's actually maybe the third largest art market in the U.S., if that matters. Lots of small galleries and independent spaces, people doing really exciting things. Big city, but doesn't feel big. It's easy mm-hmm. for you to meet the people who are in charge, as like the Contemporary Arts Museum, for example. Very easy to mingle with these top brass, if you will. Then moving over here, it's a slightly different. It's kind of interesting. We're nearer to New York and so forth, mm-hmm. but in some ways further away from New York artistically than Houston is, in terms of people coming from New York and working in Houston, going back and forth to New York, stuff like that. So it's very interesting. Anyway, so a small town I'm from doesn't have much contemporary art, very traditional Hispanic majority, mm-hmm. Traditional art, but no real museums that are showing, I guess you could call it cutting edge art if you want. So growing up seeing more traditional stuff, so I guess, Western style, a lot of cow skulls, which maybe that is actually kind of cool. Mm. So wanting to see good art, or I'll say good art or music, things like that, 2 hours north, 3 hours north, Austin, San Antonio, things mm-hmm. like that, right? So I grew up reading comic books, drawing yeah. comics, selling comics to my friends when I was in first grade, second grade, things like that. People told me I did a good job at drawing. Maybe that was just it, and it went from there.
What titles were you drawn to? I was a comics guy, too.
Oh, almost all the Marvel stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm still really interested in the Silver Surfer as a character, mm-hmm. but in a different sense. I'm not so much interested in the superhero genre anymore in a very traditional sense, but Silver Surfer is upset. I think he's a very obsessive character, and nobody has focused on the fact that, I mean, they speak about he's guilty because he helped Galactus devour planets, mm-hmm. Obviously. So it's like a mass murderer in a sense. And then his memory comes back and he realizes, oh, I've been helping.
Look at what I've done.
Yeah. And so there's a focus on that, but not to the extent that I would like to focus on guilt
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of that classic Marvel neuroticism.
Yeah, and I would like to like really dig into what makes him think he's an angel now, but there's so much guilt behind that, you know. So Silver Surfer is somebody that I still really love as a really conflicted character. I think he should be psychologically on the edge constantly.
Right. Well, you've announced that tonight's exhibit encompasses everything from the work of Bob Dylan to the meaning of friendship to cannibalism. How do you reconcile all of these seemingly different topics and influences?
Oh, right. Identity and influence, right? Shifting identities constantly, changing constantly right now. This thing that's happening between us, I think those are... I look at cannibalism as another example of consuming another person's interests, learning something from that friend or that other, perhaps with a capital O there or something. So I really got into shock films, the Italian cannibal films of the late 70s, early 80s, especially Cannibal Holocaust by the director Ruggero Deodato, 1980. So that caused an uproar because the murder scenes in that were very realistic for the time. He had to go to court and so forth to prove that he didn't actually impale a character in the film. It's not wonderful stuff. There's bad things that happened in there in terms of animal cruelty and so forth that I would never support, of course, but as a cultural study, why those films in Italy were occurring and why they were so gruesome is a really fascinating thing. How does friendship connect to that? When I was a teenager, my friends who were shock film enthusiasts before me, there was a party we had one night, and my friends introduced me to Cannibal Holocaust is playing during this party. And so I look back at that as a rite of passage in some sense, watching this thing with my metalhead friends and the shock in that and what that meant, and just remembering that moment with my friends. So I've been doing some pieces related to that moment of watching that film. One of the songs in the soundtrack is called Savage Rite. So I consider that a savage rite, maybe especially in Western culture. Then I just started thinking about the other connections about other cultures also in this, their idea behind cannibalism. Not always a vicious thing, you know, it was actually after death, perhaps. It's a different term, I think, for when it's necro-cannibalism, gaining some of their essence and so forth.
Yeah.
And there's obviously tongue-in-cheek stuff along with this.
Right,
too.
Right.
Yeah, I don't want to sound overtly serious there, but...
Well, the subject of death and dying is a predominant theme with many Latin American artists, Frida Kahlo, Salvador Dali. Tell me how you're able to get something fresh out of that, something fresh out of flesh.
The way it's been happening for me is I haven't been overthinking it, and people might say that it isn't really fresh, and that's fine, too. I haven't been thinking about it that way, but I've been connecting style with it in a lot of ways, the skull as a sense of style. I play around with the idea of styles, artists' styles, and what that means. Al Calderaro from Gallery A here in Richmond, which I think is the
right. And best. You've exhibited there.
Yeah, currently.
You were in a group show.
Yeah,
right?
Which is still going on for the next 2 weeks. It's been extended, so check that out. There's some fantastic work in there, not just because my own's in there, of course. But he mentioned the skull image that I have in there, which is a looped image. Well, he referenced it as being a historical loop, too, or a human loop, the idea of the skull. I thought that was a fantastic way of thinking about that, and I hadn't thought about it that way. But so I think that the skull just becomes this loop thing, this style loop, or in wherever we want to put it, in punk rock, in metal, in film, but then our interest in the skull in terms of being a human being, you know. And I've been associating it with style, so I have black denim in my drawings. With the skull on top of them. It's almost ridiculous. Black t-shirts, stuff like that. Moving to Richmond has made me start thinking about style differently, not just style as an artist, but a musician, but also this different look that Richmond has.
Right, right. Well, you're a musician too. Talk a little bit about that. Is it you do music for a while, then you go back to art and back to music? How does it work?
Right. Yeah. I wish I had a little more time for music right now, but that's basically how it is for me. Some things maybe sound better in a song when I did that, you know, and then other times the stuff that I'm doing right now is making more sense in these drawings or videos. But yeah, it's back and forth. I've had bands for years, pretty much only one that was consistent in Texas, which was named Communal Death Duck. You can hear stuff for free online. Everything's free,
or
right?
CDD, for sure.
CDD, yeah. You can find everything online because nobody's buying anything anyway anymore. So just take it.
Hey, I want to make sure I mention this. Vakla is very busy right now. You've got the show premiering tonight on the bus, but on Thursday you're sponsoring an exhibit at the Carytown Bicycle Company by the Cuban artist and Richmond resident Alejandro Cedeno.
Yeah, and you know, this is another story of expectations and how, you know, you can Alejandro Cedeno is a is an engineer at MeadWestvaco. He's Cuban born.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a fascinating guy.
He's very fascinating. He's still got a subtle accent, which is really cool. He's an artist as well. He started a nonprofit called Dancing Classrooms because he's interested in ballroom dancing and classic dancing. But he's also an abstract expressionist painter. Well, yeah, you know, maybe that's too much of a limited category.
Well, he's a very Jackson Pollock, I thought, looking at his work.
Right. And so we've got an interview coming out with him on our blog, Vakla-esque, our Tumblr. It's that idea again. It's going to go on. You're right. It's from 6 to 10 at Carytown Bikes. DJ Carlito, who has a show on WRIR, is going to be
DJing. Spin the tunes, right?
Spin some cool Latin. He's an amazing, he knows about music from all over the world. So he's going to spin some good Latina tunes, and there'll be wine and
some
more
dirt. Could be a future guest on this program, too, I might add, in a couple weeks.
Yeah, I think he just released a collection of, music from
Malaysia.
Malaysia. Yeah. So he's a great cultural warrior, as it were, trying to get people to recognize the value of different cultural expressions. But Alejandro's an amazing guy, lots of energy, and at the same time, he's a corporate engineer. Mm-hmm.
Man who wears many hats.
Wears many hats, a Renaissance man, I guess, if you will, an audiophile as well, loves music, and come out.
And you're going to have the bus out there, too, with Norberto's...
We're going to have that installation there, hopefully in the back, and... Also, we'll have a video of the describing the program, Dancing Classrooms, that Alejandro Cedeno has recently started. He's got a Kickstarter campaign out there, so you might look for that, trying to raise some money to get that to spread that to some more schools. So, come on out.
Yeah, that's Thursday night.
Next Thursday night at Carytown Bikes. It'll be a fun event.
Well, I'm Don Harrison, and I've been speaking to Spencer Turner, the executive director of the Virginia Center for Latin American Art, and artist Norberto Gomez Jr. An exhibit of new drawings by Gomez will be on display tonight in Vakla's mobile art bus, which will be parked at 401 West Broad Street during tonight's First Friday Art Walk. For more information on Vakla, go to vakla.org.
Yes.
That's vaclaa.org. And for more information on Norberto Gomez Jr., go to norbertogomezjr.com. That's norbertogomezjr.com.
And like our Facebook page as well. You'll get the most up-to-date information there.
Well, gracias.
Gracias a ti.
You're listening to Open Source RVA on 97.3 LPFM WRIR.
In the chutes and ladders game that is urban public education, there are many slippery chutes that lead from the cradle to prison. One of those chutes, one that far too many Richmond students slide down, is truancy. In recent years, the city has maintained a pretty steady statistic of more than 1,800 cases of unexcused absences per year. But last year, only 77 of those cases made their way to court, where those students and their parents might be compelled to re-engage with the education that might help them move ahead in life. The problem with truancy enforcement in the city of Richmond is that we know someone is supposed to be doing it, but we're not sure how much of it is being done. Nor do we know how they're doing it, or for that matter, who exactly they are. It's a problem spotlighted in a series of recent investigative reports appearing on the twin Richmond education news websites, Save Our Schools and The Cranky Taxpayer. One of those sites, Save Our Schools, is maintained by former Richmond school board member Carol A.O. Wolf. Ms. Wolf joins me today to talk about the reporting she's done with her colleague, John Butcher. More on him in a bit. But first, I'm also joined by Shonda Harris-Muhammad and Tichy Pickney-Epps, both recently elected Richmond School Board members. Ms. Epps is a longtime advocate for students in Richmond, and Ms. Muhammad is a math specialist in Petersburg Public Schools with decades of experience as an educator. So we all agree that truancy is an issue in Richmond Public Schools. So let's start with Carol. How did you get started on this issue, and what have you found?
I initially started looking at it to try to figure out why the dropout rate had jumped so high, because we had a 10 percentage points increase in it. And you know, then the reality, and I'm studying those numbers, and John Butcher's studying them, and the reality is that our dropouts, I mean, were first truants. And so it's to go upstream and figure out, you know, who's throwing these kids out here so they become a dropout.
So real quick, the 10% increase was from this year to last year, or between last year and this year?
Mm-hmm.
So a 10% increase in that short period of time.
Yep.
And again,
that information is available on the VDOE website.
And then again, you're basically reverse engineering it and realize that it's truancy that is it's the gateway drug. So
that's the gateway drug, exactly. And we put too many kids out, and we don't, you know, we have been lax about, and I still say we, because I do feel for the school board and to get our kids back in, and I know they all have, you know, the best of all intentions here. But these numbers don't lie, and that is, we can't teach them if we can't reach them.
If they're not in the school, there's not much you can do.
Nope.
So, Ms. Muhammad and Ms. Epps, thoughts on this? I mean, this is it's an issue that you guys have identified too?
It is a problem, and it is an alarming problem, which impacts and has been since the standards of learning have been in play in the Commonwealth of Virginia. It impacts now our annual measurable objectives. It used to be called the annual yearly progress, AYP.
Right.
So our students' attendance impacts if a school, or it is a factor if a school is going to be accredited or not.
And this will impact to your federal funding in some
Absolutely.
Ways.
Absolutely, yes.
And all kinds of things. You're frankly, even all the way down to your real estate value.
Yes. And with that, it is so important for society to understand, for persons who may not quite grasp what a child loses when they miss 5 days. If they're on a traditional block, 7-day period, which most of us in this room grew up on, 7 periods a day, 55 minutes, then that's 385 minutes lost in a day of instruction. If they miss 5 days a week, then that's 2,695 minutes of instruction.
They're about lost.
Absolutely. And you cannot gain 2,695 minutes of instruction back in one day.
Education is cumulative.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So you guys are new. You're the new board. And in fact, the board is overwhelmingly new. You're trying to put in place some things that might help to recapture some of these students? Or what is the strategy?
Chris, we're currently looking at that in partnership in collaboration with juvenile justice, the same people who have pretty much been at the table in the past that unfortunately, under whose ever watch, it went wrong. It's going pretty bad. So we've got to identify really what is the root of this problem. Are children being forced out? And or are they just not coming, and get to the why? And so I started out by saying that, you know, we've got these collaborative partnerships on the table. Folks are in these rooms having the discussions, but I have the distinct advantage of having been on the ground. The resources, we've got to do a better job at connecting these resources. We've got to get the politics out of the way, because as we sit and play with each other, we're losing children.
Now, I want to come back to something you just said in a minute, the forced out thing, because that intrigues me.
Push-outs.
But first, I guess if we could get to the who and the why of this. Carol, in your reporting, you're looking at this and you're finding a confusing octopus, I guess, of who's in charge, who's on first.
Who's on first. And the and one of the problems that this effort has in front of it right here is that for the past few years we have had no official attendance officers, and that is a problem when it comes to going out and picking up kids.
So we have...
We have no
attendance officers, no truant officers. Who are they supposed to report to, or who are they supposed to come through?
By law, they are supposed to report to the superintendent. I mean, that is, and she is charged by the Constitution to do that.
The Virginia Constitution.
Yes.
Now, I remember under Wilder, under former Mayor L. Douglas Wilder, he saw this as an issue as well and came in and kind of grabbed the bull by the horns and decided he was going to be enforcing this. And there was some enforcement that was happening.
Right.
Now he's not here anymore. Is that part of the problem?
That's hard to say because the money that was allocated has been spent. We're not doing the sweeps anymore. We've got people coming to school board complaining about, the truancies and the lack of, just this very last meeting, and how it increases the crime rate.
Finding kids out on the street, so to
speak. Exactly. So whatever the city is doing or the school system's doing, and they've got dual efforts here. But I don't know that both sides are really talking to one another. And they're each protecting, their turf.
Now let's go back to that forced out. And this is an issue. I know I've reported, done some reporting, and one of the things that was really disturbing when I was looking into suspensions, and this was years ago when I was with Style Weekly, and Richmond had a phenomenal number of suspensions when I was reporting. I think we had almost as many suspensions as students, is what I recall, or half as many suspensions as students, compared to D.C., which had 1,000, and they were worried about their suspension rates. One of the things I was finding as I was talking to parents about it was that a child would be put out of school, but it would be sort of an unofficial suspension. And getting the child back in school requires first the parent meeting with administration before they'd be allowed back in. And the parents would complain that they had trouble getting through to administration to even set up that meeting so that they could get their child back in. And there was some vague suggestions that this was being done somewhat purposefully. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like that's what we're getting at here is this idea of kind of forcing a child out. They might be a child that's difficult to get over a test, or they've been identified as one that's going to be difficult to test on these standardized tests. Mm-hmm. Teachy, is that what you're referring to?
Some of that. Mostly it's our zero tolerance policies. It's ultimately...
So this is official channels.
Yes, when we look at our elementary levels, that we kind of start that cradle to prison pipeline when you look at suspending second graders for, and instead of putting some other interventions in place. Again, I don't think this has been practiced as of late, but I was astonished to learn at one time, depending on how many unexcused absences a child received, then you ultimately, that equated to a suspension. And so we've just got to do an opportunity of, we've got to rethink some of our past practices.
It's an interesting idea that we would object strongly to the idea of corporal punishment in Richmond Public School, spanking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But the idea of suspending a second grader or a first grader is something that is done daily in Richmond Public Schools or around the state, really.
And it should not be because a second grader being suspended, first of all, depends on what the offense is.
Now, there's another side to this coin, and it's an important other side of the coin.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I guess it's a three-sided coin in a way. Administrations are somewhat incentivized, and it's really a bad word to use, but they're somewhat incentivized to try and keep kids like this out because of things like No Child Left Behind, ironically, but standardized testing, because you're trying to keep your standardized testing scores up so high, and year-over-year improvements with them, you can only show those if you're able to show those.
Absolutely.
And if you've got these kids that are very difficult to get over the hump, there's sort of a tendency to lump them towards those rooms where they have the in-school suspension or to see them go out.
Right,
school.
And in our minds, we want to do the right thing, and that's why we have ISS in place, because we don't want to send the child home. But the baby is still between a rock and a hard place, because if the teacher that or the person that is serving as an ISS coordinator or a teacher is not certified in all four content areas, the child is still missing some valuable information, even though, particularly in my school district, we have it so set up that teachers go and visit the children from teachers from each content area go and visit the children in ISS so they can get that instruction.
Presumably some of that had to do with the state intervention in Petersburg.
Intervention, absolutely.
Right. And what you're saying here, this is what Petersburg does. This is not what Richmond does.
This is not what Richmond does.
And in fact, is this a Petersburg fix to a problem? It sounds kind of like that. Like there was an issue, they identified the issue.
And it has helped. And it has helped greatly because not only are we providing in-house interventions with the help of the parent or guardian, and if they have a caseworker, but it's all hands on deck. We are in a tested, driven society. That is nothing new. 2001, Nation at Risk made that happen many, 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 many years ago. Then we headed into No Child Left Behind around 01, 02. That forced not only money and resources to be a factor for educating and meeting the needs of children, but also it forced school districts to place that burden on classroom instructors. Well, first the administrators, and then it was placed on the classroom teachers. And so we look at, if this doesn't happen, you know, I need this percentage in this content area so we can look good. But the underlining issue is you may have an 82%, but there is still 17-18% that's still left behind.
This is like banking at this point, or business. Mm-hmm. You're looking at your end numbers rather than at the product. In fact, we're looking at it as a product. And these are children. This is not a product.
They're children. And we were looking at them as data. And children are more than just a percentage point.
Now, Carol, some of the data that's being reported is not, well, first of all, some of it is absolutely flooring, but some of it, too, is not quite up to snuff.
Well, it's hard to trust it because, you know, there have been so many times when Richmond Public Schools has not accurately reported their information to VDOE. And VDOE is charged with making sure that the truancy and attendance statutes are upheld. Okay, that's their job.
And they've had problems with expulsions,
recording expulsions. You remember that, where it claimed that we'd only had one expulsion in an entire year. And anybody who's been anywhere in this town knows that that's not true.
Right. Okay. And then I guess there was also VGLA. Right?
VGLA numbers. And we
VGLA
had,
being an alternative test to the SOLs.
The alternative
test. Phased out because it was such a problem.
Well, right. And Butcher and I investigated that, and, you know, we had a bill go through the General Assembly that received, it was House Bill 304, and that received unanimous support. And I don't think we've had much of that.
Not much unanimous, no.
Not
for the record,
unanimous.
I covered the expulsion thing, and it ended up having some sort of General Assembly action taken on that as well.
Right, right. But see, I would prefer that, I mean, at least in the case of Richmond, because I do, you know, I have invested a lot of energy in, you know, trying to improve the schools here. And I would really like to see this board take charge and make sure that the administration is held accountable on this. We can't, you know, as a board member, you can't go out and do a sweep, but you can certainly find out why those sweeps aren't being done. And when we have people coming to school board meetings and saying, you got to do something, you're not doing the sweeps anymore, and these kids are out here on the streets and they don't know what to do, and, you know, they're just getting into mischief. And sometimes it's mischief with a lowercase m and sometimes with a big. So you've got to do something. And right now, the kids are running amok, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Teachy mm-hmm. And Shonda, mm-hmm. were you aware of this problem as being as big a problem as what Carol is reporting?
I was aware.
Anecdotally or probably more?
Say that again, Dan.
More anecdotally, I guess. Mm-hmm. You're aware of it as, like, I'm sure that there's a problem there.
Certainly. And in addition to that, I was once a teacher in Richmond City Public Schools when Carol Wolf was on the school board. And I taught at John F. Kennedy and then did summer school many years at John Marshall and summer school many years at MLK.
So I
knew very well that we had an attendance problem. And we continue to have an attendance problem when we do not have assigned persons to that program. To the attendance program. I would like for not only the attendance clerks to report to the superintendent according to the Constitution, but have a board policy that states they also need to report to the board.
So you guys need to have oversight.
Absolutely. We need to have oversight. And I am not a micromanager. However, when this much negativity comes to light in such a time frame, back to back, you know, truancy, other issues, VGLA, mm-hmm. Lack of reporting correctly, things of that nature, it is incumbent upon us to say we have to have all hands on deck for a little while. I think it's very unique, as I was sharing with Ms. Pinkney Epp, she has that strength of being grass-rooted in the community and having had relationships already cultivated with these families who she is now working with on the discipline committee. I look at my strength coming from the instructional side, decades in education, as you can't just shoot me anything because I'm fully aware of the process.
Right.
And I know what we have to report. And if you don't give it to me, I know where I can go get it. So I have relationships built with people at Virginia Department of Education over years, over the time. So I can easily call and say, hey, Susan,
I want it.
This is Shonda.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Help me out here. I need to know what's going on. But they can only report out what's reported to them. Someone can say.
And that's what I was finding.
Absolutely.
Too. Yeah.
Something just doesn't seem right, and you should ask it this way. And then that will push a little buttons. You know, mm-hmm. it is very challenging for us to be 7 out of 9 new. And the first year, probably 18 months, will be very challenging because, you know, people think the budget, the budget, the budget. But it's not just the budget. It's also the VGLA. It's also attendance. It's also truancy. It's also morale. It's also instruction. It's also pushing our teachers to deal with students' behaviors when they're not trained to deal with certain erratic behaviors.
You have years of systemic issues that mm-hmm. you're trying very quickly to try and come to grips with.
And we have placed, as I believe, this is just Shonda Harris Muhammad talking, a Band-Aid on that. And we have not allowed the wound to heal. So we have to take the Band-Aid off, and we have to leave it off.
And assess the wound, probably.
And assess mm-hmm. the wound. And I have learned as an administrator and as a supervisor that I can get more from you with honey than I can with vinegar.
So, Teachy, you've seen a little bit of honey and vinegar, I guess, in your days. some of what you were doing before you were on school board was you were with communities and schools and were literally in one of the schools. I know I used to talk with you quite a bit about some of the problems you were seeing in the school, anecdotal. But what do you do now that you're on the board? Can you think of any solutions that you'd like to see put in place or thoughts on?
I do. And I think definitely the word for the day will be accountability. As board members, it's going to be our responsibility to get in there and really understand what's going on and hold some folks accountable. If I can just shed a little of the background light on maybe how truancy is once again at the forefront, it's my understanding as a result of the detention center, that being closed.
And that was earlier in the fall, I guess. Mm-hmm.
That there was a comprehensive look at, you know, let's look at justice services as a whole. And I think it was then that it was determined that, you know, there's been this agreement that the superintendent had the authority over these attendance officers, but then they weren't properly certified or they weren't being used in that function.
So this might be a good time to reassess, essentially.
Yes, it's a perfect time to reassess. And I know at least the assessment from 2 years ago, it started 2 years ago, I was in the room with truancy. I was in the room with the attendance personnel. I was in the room with the other CISI coordinators. And the question on the table is, how do we address this truancy and attendance? And I have to be honest, it's disheartening for me that for 2 years these conversations took place and we have not gotten to the action. And you all know for me, I'm kind of I want it done tomorrow. We cannot talk this horse that we've killed back to life.
So we're heading towards action now. We've got a new board.
Yes.
We've got Carol doing some reporting. And again, I've been with Shonda Harris Muhammad and Teachy Pinkney Epps. They're both brand new, spanking new members of Richmond Public Schools School Board. And I'm also with Carol Ale Wolf, who is a former school board member with Richmond. And she is also now in her new life. or old life, I guess, to return to her old life, a reporter.
Right.
Doing investigative reporting on Richmond Public Schools at her website, which is Save Our Schools, Get Real Richmond blogspot. Thank you guys.
We don't need to be leaving all of our
children. Thank you for having us. We really appreciate your support.
I'm very glad that you guys could come in today. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for February 1st, 2013. I'm Amy Daniel, and my co-hosts are Chris Dovey and Don Harrison. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi, and the board ops are Brian and Manon. The part of Darren has been played this week by Mike McKenzie. Hey, have you heard about our worldwide website on the internet? It's our own little intersection of creativity and spirituality, and it's a place for breaking news, show podcasts, and further information on our interviewees. Just remember, goodbye doesn't mean forever. So we'll see you next week on WRIR's Audio News Digest, Open Source RVA.
Need a little help from my friends one time. Blow your whistle. So I need from my friends one time, blow you a whistle. They need little help from my friends one time, blow you a whistle. They need little help from my friends one time, blow you a whistle.